A Biblical Sexual Ethic, the third talk in a series entitled Understanding and Living with the Dynamics of Sex, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 10, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, I lied last week. I told you that I thought we were talking about romance and romantic love this week. That's actually next week. I just made a mistake in my calendar, in the calendar in my head. So we're talking about a theory of sexual ethics today. I'll make a few preliminary remarks here off of the outline, and then we'll just go and have a free-flowing conversation, and Ron and Nancy will help me. Okay? In order to talk about sexual ethics, we need to talk about ethics in general, it seems to me. So I start here with some comments on a general ethical theory from a biblical perspective. It seems to me that we have to ask the question, what's evil about evil from a biblical perspective? And at the heart of evil is rebellion against God. But to rebel against God involves a number of different things. There's different elements to our rebellion against God. It would not only be hostility toward God himself, but it would be hostility toward anything and everything that God is and that God stands for would also be a part of that rebellion. So it would be rebellion against what is good, rebellion against what is right, rebellion against what is true, and rebellion against what is ultimately beautiful would all be a part of this rebellion against God that is, from a biblical perspective, evil. So what's evil about it is ultimately its rejection of God. There's five different aspects to evil, then, it seems to me. Hostility to God's character, that is, failing to like God. Hostility to God's role, failure to trust God as the sovereign director and author of all reality. Hostility to God's values, a disregard for truth and goodness or purity. Hostility to God's creation, the actual created order that he created. So transgression of the various, to throw in a Greek word, telloi, that are embodied in the rationality, the logos of the created order. The perspective being that from a biblical perspective, God is a rational being who created a rational universe that has a rational order to it. And part of the rational order of the created order is that things have a purpose and a function and a role that fit together into the overall purposes of God's creation. So if we're hostile to that created order, then we are hostile to the creator of that created order as well. And then finally, hostility to God's purposes. And what I have in mind there is that God's ultimate purpose is not for us to have a place in this world that we ultimately are at home and are fulfilled and find our being given substance in this world. This is just a stepping stone to something bigger and better and above and beyond. That's just the way God is running his universe. If I reject that and I decide that I want what I want now, that kind of what the Bible calls worldliness is a rejection of God's greater purposes. So ethical theory, point C, is anything which involves one or more of the five aspects of sin that are listed above, those five things. Any of those things or any combination of those things from a biblical perspective would make something morally wrong, evil. Just a note, this is just sort of a parenthetical comment, but it's important to realize that biblical ethics is not what ethicists would call a consequentialist view of ethics. You don't judge something wrong because the consequences are bad. From a biblical point of view, things are wrong because of their relationship to God, even if the consequences ended up being good by accident. That wouldn't make the action right. There's still the issue, the problem, that it's been motivated by and driven by this one of these sorts of hostilities that I listed here. And if that's the case, then the consequences really don't make any difference. Oftentimes you find Christian, the consequentialist view of ethics is just embedded in our culture today because any social political discussion that you hear is always argued on the basis of the consequences of an action. So it's already a kind of a foreign perspective than the biblical worldview already, by virtue of the fact that it's relying upon a consequentialist view of ethics. So oftentimes, even in the churches, why not have sex before marriage? Because you might get pregnant. Because you might get an STD. Because this, because that. I mean, some consequence is why you don't do what you do. That whole line of argument would be alien and foreign to a biblical worldview. It doesn't matter if you escape all consequences. If it's wrong, it's wrong. If it's hostile to your creator, it's hostile to your creator. So the biblical sexual ethics, point two, can only be determined in the context of a biblical theory of human sexuality, and that's what I talked about last week and what we discussed and had a conversation about last week. So I won't revisit that ground, but there's no way that we can understand what is and is not hostile to God's creation and God's purposes and God's values if we don't understand what God intended human sexuality to be. So that's why last week's discussion is so crucial to this. But in the light of what we talked about last week, then, there are, four cardinal virtues of biblical sexual ethics. The first one would be monogamous sexual intimacy. Sex is created by God to be that language that spouses use, husband and wife use, to ratify, to celebrate, to delight in the moral commitment that they've made to one another, to be married to one another to the end of their days. That's what sex is for, primarily. It's not primarily for procreation. It's not primarily for pleasure. It's primarily to be this language that we use to communicate this kind of intimate commitment that we have to one another in marriage. So any adulterous sexual intimacy is wrong. Sexual intimacy is defined as any intimate knowledge of another that is sought because of erotic interest in the other person or given because of his or her erotic interest in me. That sexual intimacy in that way or that intimate knowledge of another outside of marriage is wrong. I've given you some working definitions of sexual intimacy there. I don't think I talked about that last week. Anything that if I were doing it with or to my flesh and blood brother or sister, and it would be considered morally inappropriate or incestuous, that's sexually intimate. Any activity which, when engaged in with someone other than my spouse, would rightly make my spouse feel cheated, jealous, angry, betrayed, or so forth, if he or she were to find out about it, then I'm doing something that's sexually intimate, that's wrong. So monogamous faithfulness is the first one. Second one, abstinence from any sexual intimacy outside of marriage at all, so premarital or any extramarital sexual intimacy whatsoever is wrong, because it's, as I expressed last week, it's a lie, it's a deception, it's a false promise. The language of my body is saying something, whether I like that or not, whether I intend it or not. So I cannot help but lie with my body, tell falsehood with my body if I am lying with my body. And I commented last week, oh, is that all? It's only a lie? Well, yes, but our moral barometer is not set right if lying doesn't bother us. And then secondly, this is not just a lie, but this is a lie that you're telling something about meeting a longing that is about as deep as any human longing goes in us. That desire to be special, that desire to be significant, that could be and would be satisfied in a marriage relationship if my marriage partner is faithful to their vows and they make me the most special person in their existence, then I have the opportunity in the context of marriage of experiencing that specialness. And that's a deep, deep longing that every human being has, that marriage has the potential for satisfying. So when we use the language of our body to go telling people that they're special, only to betray them later by not giving my life to them, by not following through with a lifelong commitment, then we're telling a really cruel and vicious lie to one another. And whole cultures can get over that by kind of, you know, numbing ourselves, anesthetizing ourselves to the pain of that kind of thing, but only at a cost to our conscience and our humanity and our, you know, our kind of moral tenderness. We have to brutalize ourselves morally in order to get okay with that constantly lying to one another through sexual intimacy. So that's the first moral virtue, monogamous sexual intimacy. The second one is what I call sexual purity. Any desire for perverse sexual behavior is wrong, and any engaging in perverse sexual behavior is wrong. And that's true whether it's inside or outside the bounds of marriage. Just marriage is not a license to be whatever you want to be sexually. It just isn't. If sexuality is this dance, it's this language, it's this intimate knowledge of one another, it's this intimate dialectic back and forth of getting to know one another in the most intimate way possible, then there are constraints on what sex should be, even inside of marriage. Perverse sexual behavior is any sexual behavior which mistakes the primary purpose of sexual intimacy and replaces it with some other purpose as of primary importance. A big one is sensuality. Sensuality, I would argue, is wrong because it replaces the primary purpose of sex with sensual pleasure, which is not the primary purpose of sex. It's a secondary purpose. It's true of sex that it is sensually pleasurable, but that's not why it's there primarily.
Mm-hmm. You said before it was okay to, yeah, while you were going along, just so that people understand at that spot, there is a thing that has happened in Christianity where people would say sensuality is bad, and what they mean is the sensual pleasures in sexuality itself are bad. I shouldn't be enjoying this. I shouldn't be seeking to enjoy it or something like that. And I just wanted to clarify, that's not what you mean when you say sensuality is bad, right? I mean, I just thought it was hysterically funny when I read it, but there's a spot in Augustine where he was trying to defend the practice of polygamy in the Old Testament and saying, well, okay, yeah, it wasn't good that they had all those wives. But basically what he says is, but when they had sex, they didn't enjoy it. So they're a lot better off than we are, who in our marriages are having sex because we want to. And that was Augustine's deep confusion. I mean, Augustine was deeply confused about sexuality, and that's not what we're trying to say here. So you might want to clarify what you do mean by that.
No, just amen. Yeah, it's exactly right. I'm defining sensuality as replacing the primary purpose of sex with sensual pleasure. But as I said last week, the fact that there is pleasure in sex is not at all a problem. God created it that way. It's not the Christian view that pleasure is wrong. That's not a Christian view. The problem comes in when I pursue that at the cost of everything else. And I lose sight of why sex is there in God's scheme of things. So sensual dissatisfaction or dissatisfaction about pleasure of sex, what often was called a few decades back sexual incompatibility, is really no basis for even self-pity, let alone divorce. Because the purpose of sex is not being thwarted if there's some reason that it's not as pleasurable as I might imagine or fantasize or want or desire or think. Sorry? Okay, yeah, number one, to turn sexual pleasure into merely an occasion of pleasure or a gourmet's delight is a perversion of God's intent. So the whole Playboy philosophy, the hedonistic philosophy, that this is all about pleasure in the final analysis, and so let's become connoisseurs of sex and learn how to do it in a way that's most pleasurable, that's a perverse orientation, perverse attitude to take. Sexual fantasizing, I would argue, is wrong. That's driven by sensuality, typically. Prostitution is often is wrong. That's driven by sensuality. Pornography is wrong, driven by sensuality. I will say, however, pornography is not adultery. Adultery is to be unfaithful in your relationship. Pornography is about sensuality, not about unfaithfulness. So I think it's wrong, but I think that we need to understand why it's wrong and get that in perspective. So any sort of bizarre, kinky, abnormal sexuality of whatever it is, and the thing that drives it is much like drug addiction, where within the context of sexuality you're looking for a bigger rush, a bigger high, a bigger adrenaline rush. And in order to get it, you need to get kinkier and kinkier and kinkier. That's the direction we will watch our culture go, because it is so given over to sensuality that sexuality is going to have to get more and more and more bizarre, more and more kinky, in order to satisfy the drive for whatever it is they're looking for, the pleasure that they're looking for, the rush that they're looking for. We can come back and talk about all that. The third one is sexual normalcy, is a prime virtue. And what I mean by that is behaving sexually in a manner fully consistent with the purposes of God for marriage and sexuality. And those purposes would ultimately be, if not defined by the Bible, would ultimately be defined by, you know, our sound judgment about just the created order itself, the nature of the design of creation as we can observe it and can make judgments about it just using reason. Rejecting procreation altogether is wrong. To see marriage as only about procreation is wrong, but to reject procreation altogether, it seems to me, is wrong. That is, if I rebel against it. I want to be married and I want to have sex, but I don't want to have to mess with any kids. I don't know how we can read the anatomy, the conclusions of our physiology, and think that God did not put sexual intimacy and procreation together, and he did that for a purpose and intended that. Yeah.
Is that an anti-contraceptive statement?
Not really, because I think one can use contraceptions without trying to divorce sexuality, separate sexuality from procreation. If you use contraceptions and they fail, as long as you can say, thank you, God, for the gift, then you haven't been trying to separate them. You've simply been trying to plan your life and control your life and so on and so forth. And I it's not clear to me that that would be a problem.
To go one more place with this. So is the rejection merely denying a child if you were to have one because contraceptives didn't work? Or, I mean, is it also just on another level of, I mean, marriage in a sense to procreate. I mean, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. Could you talk about that rejection a little bit more? Because the majority of people our age that are getting married, have no desire for children. It's not in their plans for their life. And mostly for, you know, blatantly self-stated selfish reasons.
Okay, then that could be wrong. Yeah, I mean, my example was just to give an example, a clear-cut case of where somebody was really attempting to make a separation between sexual intimacy and procreation, and we know that's what they're trying to do by their reaction to its failure. So I didn't mean that that's the only thing that would make it right. What I mean is it's really ultimately a frame of mind, I think. And I would imagine that there are people your age getting married who actually have a wrong kind of attitude toward procreation, that they really don't want it to intrude in their life at all, and that's kind of a rebellious attitude. And I would say that's wrong on the one hand. On the other hand, the idea that my thinking is we will start having children in 2 years after da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and so that's what we're going to try to plan to do, to use birth control in that way, contrary to Roman Catholic theology, I don't see a problem with that. Because Roman Catholic theology is predicated on the notion that the purpose of sex is procreation. And I don't think that's true. So I come to a different conclusion about that. Did that? Let me just finish up here real quick, and then we'll open it all up. A second part of behavior and attitudes that mistake the nature and character of marriage are, the other one is homosexuality. And that's becoming more and more a controversial issue in this day. But from a biblical perspective, homosexuality is wrong. It rejects the clear purpose of God to have the marital relationship between a man and a woman. And we don't know ultimately, exactly why. But an obvious fact is that men and women are profoundly different from one another. And God's purpose in marriage was to bring two individuals that are profoundly different from one another into this commitment to strive to know, respect, love, and serve one another. And it's that love and service across the difference that is crucial to making marriage play the purpose that God intended for it to play. In that regard, note that something can be obviously and transparently a violation of God's purposes and hence of God's created order, his natural law, without it being at all obvious how to articulate exactly how and why it is in violation of God's purposes and his creation. And I think that's crucial to appreciate that comment in the light of the social political conversations that are going to go on in your future. The perspective of Paul in Romans is, it's obvious that it violates God's created order for men to be sexually intimate with men and women to be sexually intimate with women. He just thinks that that's obvious. Something can be obvious that you can just kind of read off of the created order without being able to articulate a formal argument that is in and of itself compelling. I mean, that's true in a lot of different areas. But just because one can't convince other people with an argument doesn't mean that you're not rightly perceiving the truth about God's created order. I mean, interestingly, there's a stronger biblical case to be made against homosexuality than could ever be made against cannibalism. But it doesn't make cannibalism right, just because I can't make a biblical case against it. And for that matter, given that you won't grant me the right assumptions, I couldn't even make a logical argument against cannibalism. As long as you don't hate them, as long as it's a loving dinner and you don't hate them when you eat it, then it's perfectly appropriate. Third one would be incest. This is a very difficult one to make the argument why it's wrong, and yet it's one of the few moral virtues that is shared across all cultures throughout almost all time. This is almost a universal taboo. And yet, how do you make the argument? It's really difficult. What is it about being biologically related that makes you not an available partner for marriage, for a marriage relationship? And then finally, the last, I would say, cardinal virtue of sexual ethics in the Bible is self-control. Self-mastery, both within and without marriage, is an important value. This is different from ascetic self-denial. This is not denying my sexuality. We talked about this a little bit last week. It's not to reject my sexuality. That's not biblical. But to recognize that I am a human being and not an animal, that I am a rational, moral, free moral agent and not an instinct-driven beast, that's crucial. I mean, even the ancient pagans understood that. And that's fully consistent with the biblical worldview as well. So selfish, insensitive, or exploitive sex of any kind whatsoever inside marriage is wrong. Just because I'm married doesn't mean I can be a beast. Doesn't mean that I can get whatever I want in any way that I want it. And in that regard, therefore, I think masturbation is wrong. And masturbation, often people experience it as degrading, disgusting, dirty. And I think the reason for that is not because sex is dirty. That's the conclusion that people often reach. But it's because I feel disgusted with myself when I can't gain self-mastery over impulses, over desires, and over inclinations within me. To say a lot of people in the world today, in fact, I had a professor once say, he thought Kant, Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, could not possibly be respected as a moral philosopher because anyone who thought masturbation was immoral was incapable of making any moral judgment whatsoever. You have a lot of Christians in society today who will defend masturbation. I know that they do that. I recognize that especially in the culture in which we live, in the climate in which we live, with the pressures, the sexual pressures that all of you face, masturbation may in fact be inevitable. But just because we can't gain mastery doesn't mean that the way to respond to the situation is, let's just call it right. Let's just call it good. Let's just call it moral. There are all kinds of things that we do all the time that are immoral that I can't seem to master, that I can't seem to get control over. Some people have difficulty telling the truth, and it's just really, really easy for them to bend the truth and exaggerate and lie. I would argue it's immoral what they're doing. But and the fact that they can't seem to do the moral thing consistently, the way to respond to that is not to say, let's just call in exaggeration moral and deal with it that way. It's very important that we keep our standards in perspective of what's right, what's truly right, what's truly good, what's truly true, and then accept the fact that we are depraved, wicked, evil beings in need of redemption, in need of mercy, in need of ultimate glorification, where that which I cannot do now is something that I will be able to do one day. But far better to accept forgiveness of that which is evil, but I am willing to call evil, than to try to bend my view, distort my view of reality, so that I can call that which is evil good. That just seems to me the better moral strategy. So, why don't you guys comment, and then we'll...
I had one... Oh, I took your microphone. Here. Otherwise, I kick this one, and then that won't work. There are a number of things that we'll want to talk about, I'm sure. But there's one point you made, Jack. I don't know if I'm disagreeing with you. I think it's more a question of vocabulary. But it was at the spot when you were saying that the problem with pornography was sensuality, and you said it's not adultery. I think that's right. I can agree with that. I mean, if you're talking about, as we try to look at the moral categories, you know, what in essence would always be the problem with pornography. I think that's right, the way you have described it. But we have a lot of people who are young and not married here, and the fact is that in practical terms, if you're talking about adultery, which is a thing that pertains to marriage, that for a husband, say, to get involved in pornography in a married situation, it may not be adultery, but it is not just sensuality. That is, I would say, part of the moral problem is that there, the wife in that situation is affected in a bad way. That is, the message that's being sent is bad. The availability for a sexual relationship with your wife is, I mean, it's kind of like this fantasy over here is more interesting to me than you are. And that may not be adultery, but it's not exactly seeking oneness either. I mean, it's a violation in that sense. So, and I know you would agree with that, but
I thought I'd make a comment about, you were talking about sensuality also. The number one where you say to turn sexual pleasure into merely an occasion of pleasure, and you talked about Augustine and you know, that it's not that the sensual pleasure is wrong. I think that it's important just to say and clarify that it doesn't, I don't think what you're saying is that in marriage, whenever I want to have sex with my spouse, I have to make sure that it's fulfilling the purpose and meaning of sexuality and think about how it's ratifying my commitment to my partner. I mean, I think it automatically does that. And so it's it can be within marriage just for fun, for example. It can be a lot of different things. It doesn't have to be sort of a this, it could sound like we have to take this really seriously, but I think it's one of the gifts from God that it is such a pleasurable thing to share with a husband or a wife, and it's okay to have fun with it. That's all I wanted to add.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, sometimes it'll be very fun and playful and whimsical. Sometimes it'll be very serious. And it just depends on the circumstances and what's going on in your lives. The main point is it's relational, not recreational. I mean that if you think of sex, even within marriage, as I'm going for pleasure, then it makes a huge big deal to you whether you get the pleasure you want or not. If you're not primarily doing it for pleasure, maybe it'll be as pleasurable as you want and maybe it won't. That's okay. It's still relational. You're still relating to your spouse. And that's the important thing, is to have the focus on the fact that it's relational, because that's what it's for.
And I was just going to comment on one other thing, and we can talk about this more, but the sensual dissatisfaction incompatibility issue, I guess I just want to add that that's a really complicated issue for people, and that it isn't... I agree with what you're saying, that it, because our sexual relationship is about relating to one another and not primarily about having it all work right, there can be a lot of different ways to be sexual together, whether or not the mechanics ever work. And I think it's really complex to bring together two people's bodies in particular responses, especially given... any kind of experiences or their introduction to that activity could have been under difficult circumstances. There's a lot, because it's such a deeply personal expression, our bodies wear the hurt that we bring with us into marriage. And so I just wanted to add that complication that often there can be a lot that can be learned in the process of even working with, this is really hard for me to be open with you in this way. And then that becomes the context in which I'm having this intimate relationship, is I need to let go of needing you to give that for me, or pressuring you into being able to do something that you're not ready to do. Or, I mean, it can just be so complex. I just wanted to add that. That people are often working with a lot there. So,
you were talking about when we. You were talking about removing children from sexual intimacy. You're saying it would be okay for like a time to plan your life.
I think I said removing children.
Well, I mean.
That sounds pretty violent.
Separating.
Yeah.
Okay. What? What about after they've already had several children? I mean, are you supposed to just keep having children, or I mean, is it wrong to stop after like 10? Jeez.
Well, no, that was my... See, that's where my view would differ from the classical Roman Catholic view. The classical Roman Catholic view is there's no reason to have sex unless you intend God to give you a child. And so they may very well say, yeah, you just need to keep having children. My contention is the primary purpose of sex is this language between a husband and wife. Unlike animal sexuality that is for procreation, that's not true of... That's not the primary purpose of human sexuality. I mean, notice that dogs are only interested if the female is in heat. That's not true of human males, in my experience. So there's something different going on in human sexuality. So if that's the case, then to try to learn enough about my sexuality to kind of manage the procreational outcome of sex, in and of itself, I don't think is any different than any other rational planning that we do in our lives. And I think that can be moral and perfectly appropriate. The only point I was making is that rational planning, I think, needs to take seriously into account that God put procreation together as a very, very possible outcome of sexual intimacy. And for us to say, God, you really messed up your creation. You should have made those separate functions so that I don't have to think in terms of procreation when I have sex.
I'm bringing this up because it's a corollary with what you said earlier about something, but it's to specifically address something partially, I think, for our sake, as well as something I have a question about. It seems to be the case that in relationships, as a guy, for myself as well as for other guys that I know, when you get involved with a girl, it's sort of, and this might be directed only at you, there seems to be this, sorry, Nancy, there seems to be the sense of, and this is premarital, but not necessarily sex, but sexual. And getting involved in a relationship, there seems to be a demanding side from the girl's perspective of getting some sort of physical manifestation of the affection you might have for that person. And it seems to be pretty universal, and I don't know if it's because of the objectification of women, as it's called now, or what it is that there's this, I mean, there, I think there's a similar desire, you know, as a guy, I can relate, but I think I can take a verbal, like a, someone verbally telling me as enough to actually like hold it off, especially when you're trying not to be physical or sexual. There seems to be a demanding side that's much stronger from girls, or else they don't feel loved. I don't know if that's, I mean, are you relating to that, or have you recognized that, or?
I'm trying to understand your question. You're identifying something that you've observed that women can tend to really need a physical connection in order to feel safe or trust that.
In order to trust feel loved, is one side of it, or
to
love,
feel
yeah.
loved. Okay.
And I don't know if that's more of a just sort of cultural thing because mm-hmm. of what seems to be. I mean, women are objectified all the time. As I'm sure they view themselves to some degree as mm-hmm. a very sexual thing, something to be desired. In a way that's maybe unnatural, stronger than normal. Because as I said, I can relate to that somewhat, but I can also do without it. Whereas I just know a number of people that have struggled with trying to reaffirm their affection for a girl, and they really just don't get it. They seem not to get it at all. And then there's always this sort of falling in and falling out of, like, you know, you want to show them that you care, you don't want to get physical, but then they demand it in a way, not to say that they're at fault for that. So then you kind of fall in the trap of trying to give them some affection, and then you feel bad, and then there's the guilty conscience. But I guess I'm trying to, number one, address this perhaps so maybe you can talk about it for the girls here themselves if they're struggling with that or dealing with that, or will be most likely, as well as the guys. I mean, as I said, it's hard for both sides. Mm-hmm. And as well as seeing if you have anything yourself to, I mean, do you relate to that at all? Is that something you can understand, or... Do you think that's way off the mark and a very like misogynistic comment or something?
Well, I'm watching a few furrowed brows along the front row here. But I'm trying to get underneath kind of what you're saying. I think that what you might be identifying is that men and women, I think, do relate very differently sexually to one another. And so for women, the sexual response is set in a context. For men, it can be a lot more just visual or I think that's changing, quite honestly. I think with what you were saying about what did you call it? Objectification of our sexuality in general, that in that sense, I think it is a cultural thing, that it's culturally derived in some ways.
And it's changing, becoming more mutual? Or
I think women are becoming more visually stimulated than they used to be. And
therefore removing the context for sexuality more.
I'm sorry, what? I don't know why I didn't follow that.
I think what Nancy's saying is that it has been true in our culture that women equate sex and love and see them as going together hand in hand, the relational aspect and the sexual aspect as being kind of inextricably bound together, whereas men have tended not to want to see it in that way. So the objectification of women, even anonymous sex, or the joke, you wake up in the morning after meeting a woman in the bar, what was your name? That sort of caricature of man has been more true, and I think what Nancy's saying, that's becoming to, it's beginning to be true of women as well.
And so I think some of that's shifting, but I think maybe what you're identifying is that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I identify with it personally, but I think what you might be talking about is, I think that there is a very deep longing for both men and women to be connected. And perhaps this is one way that it shows up in some of the women that you and your friends have had experience with.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer the question. I mean, I would, especially I just don't want to get myself in trouble and say I know what women are thinking about things or anything like that. But I think what Walter's talking about is something that in Christian relationships, where both are committed to wanting to be sexually pure, and they're coming together and they're trying to figure out, how are we going to do this thing? I think what Walter's talking about is that the guy is trying to draw this line and say, for me, I need to stay over here. Let's just not have this, and we're going to keep this as unphysical as possible because I'm trying to behave myself.
I think both people try to draw that line.
Right. But both are trying to draw that morally, or they're committed to that. But what he's saying is that he's hearing guys saying that there's the thing in the girl side. It's not that she wants to get some hot and bothered thing happening, but that the physical aspect is that communicates this. It makes me feel like I'm special to you, and that it's more important to her that we have some sort of thing like that, that I feel reassured that this relationship is important. And it creates a problem for the guy in that now he's being drawn into something. So it's kind of like he's finding it difficult. Now he's being drawn into something that now it's harder to keep that line where he would like it to be. And what I think what Walter's saying is it would be easier for the guy to say, let's just keep this platonic so that we can keep ourselves the way we want to be, and that there is a certain longing for, but let's express our relationship together here. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I have seen it happen. So I know that it does happen.
That's exactly what I was trying to articulate and said much better than I did.
Okay.
I'm on drugs from my pain medicine.
Yeah,
well, it's my excuse.
Yeah.
Thanks. Solidarity, Ron. Thanks.
Okay, that makes more sense to me now. And so is there a question that goes with that, or is it just it's more of an observation and kind of to become aware so that women in particular can really be aware of, we'll get more into this as we go along, I think, but one of the things that I'm going to talk about at some point, I think, is how we can be responsible with ourselves, and that each person needs to practice being responsible with our needs and our desires. And I think that is a mark of that, maybe in a way, that there is this real draw and need for some kind of communication that says, we're in this, right? And yet, I mean, that's also going to be addressed, I think, when we talk about the role for romance and whether or not we even want to get into that sort of a relationship sequentially or before we're ready to decide, are we going to be married? So I don't know if that doesn't really answer me.
I think his question was, is that a cultural reality, or is there something innate about sexual differences that may...
That's part of the question. The other question is, I guess, as a guy... asking a woman who I'm not involved in a relationship with at the time or anything, is there some way to get past that without just falling into that? I mean, maybe it's necessary to be physically affectionate. I mean, on the one hand, I recognize that's probably going against your sexual ethics, but maybe that is necessary in order to show it, to communicate that. But I don't really know. I'm not trying to say I want to go down that way, but...
Let me make one comment in that regard. What's really uncomfortable when you're in a relationship and you're looking at the prospects of getting into a marriage relationship eventually, and you just don't know who this person is, you know? Are they committed? Do they love me? Are they that future husband or whatever? The insecurity of that is horrendous. And what we want to do is solve the problem of that insecurity. And I think the pressure that you feel, however it manifests itself, whether with some kind of physical affection to communicate that or what, I think that's what's trying to be addressed, is I don't know where I stand. Let me find out where I stand here.
Right.
And I would argue that I think it really is very important that we allow ourselves to live with the insecurity until that resolves itself in time. We want to prematurely get rid of the insecurity by knowing what is not even knowable.
I think
I'm asking the dude, are you going to marry me one day? And he doesn't know. He hasn't resolved. He hasn't made a commitment. He hasn't made up his mind. So he can't really very well tell you something that he doesn't know yet. And it goes the other direction, too. I mean, I certainly felt it. When I was getting around to asking Jody to marry me, there were times where I was just incredibly insecure about where I stood with her. I can remember literally having to stamp on my hand to keep myself from calling her on the phone one night. And it healed. But I had enough sense to realize that it wasn't fair to her. The only thing I wanted is to call her up and say, where do I stand? And I had enough sense to know she doesn't know. Why am I trying to shift the burden that I'm feeling, the insecurity and the fear that I'm feeling, off onto her? Just bear it, you know. Live with the discomfort here, live with the pain, and just be patient. It'll resolve itself in time, so just be patient. I think that's important. I think we're looking for information often that we can't possibly give one another yet.
I think that's. Thank you for saying that, and I think I'm inclined to agree. Based on, I mean, the idea of, I mean, obviously, loving someone is different than showing them that you love them. I mean, it's often there's going to be, I guess, the anxieties amidst any sort of loving aspect of just living.
Walter, it seems like something else that might be playing into what you're experiencing could be, it seems in my experience that different people have different ways of showing their affection, and one of those ways is through physical contact. And so that might be a girl's primary way of showing affection. And in the relationship, you know, maybe the guy has a different style of communicating his care for someone. And so the girl might be expecting, well, this is how I show people I care for them. Like, this is my primary method of communication. So she might be expecting the same thing back and not getting it, and so being confused. I mean, I'd agree with everything else it's saying, but that's just another thing that could be present.
I know that pornography can be a rather broad category, but would you say that things like movies, TV shows, music videos, etc., that are, say, driven by sensuality or involve disregarding of biblical sexual ethics in general, Would you consider them immoral to watch?
But, you know, I don't have an easy answer to that question, Michael. I have struggled with that issue myself. I find it easy in some ways to draw the line for myself that I think there are things out there I can't even watch anymore. I mean, when music videos started, I loved music videos. I mean, when MTV started, I thought this was so cool, making movies to songs. I love songs. I love movies. So make a movie with a song. This is like the greatest thing in the world. And I loved that. But yeah, that's right. But I can't turn on. I mean, I have tried occasionally to see, I wonder what music videos are like these days. And I turn on MTV and I go, oh my God. I have to go stick my head in a sink or something. It's awful. So I find it relatively easy to say, okay, there are places where I think we have just gone too far. But I have always loved movies, and I like movies that are done by people who are talented and intelligent and who are making me think about things that are worth thinking about and interesting, or just doing something in a very entertaining way. I love that kind of stuff, and sometimes the movies that are done by the people that are the best at that stuff go to places that I feel uncomfortable going. And I'm just speaking, I'm not dictating to anyone. I'm just saying personally, I struggle with that. When I was younger, I would watch anything. I had no sense that perversion played any role, that it was something to be avoided. Perversion was the spice you put in to make it interesting. And the over the years, besides the fact that I would recognize personally that it's not good for me, I wrestle with that. You know, there was a lot of thoughtfulness and intelligence and skill in this movie, and I really liked it in some ways, but I feel like this was one more little erosion of my guard against things that are just not true and worthwhile. And that gets hard. Sometimes I see things and I think, you know, I shouldn't have watched that. Sometimes I see things and I think, oh, that was good. And maybe that's even worse, you know, that I wasn't thinking I shouldn't have watched that because I probably shouldn't have. But I think that all I can say is that I'm convinced that there is not, that being pure as a Christian does not involve necessarily not confronting evil. That is, I don't have a problem with stories that take me into the heart of evil and show me something about what it's like, as long as there is a framework in which to understand that and deal with it. So I can go that far. But sometimes I just feel like not only has this taken me, I mean, there may even be a moral vision behind the movie, but it's awfully easy to justify, let's have a couple of minutes of something really perverse and titillating in the midst of this moral structure that I've constructed, and that way I can feel good about it afterwards. You know, I can watch it and feel virtuous at the end. And that just gets really tricky. So I think all of us, I mean, we all need to be aware. We are in a very visual culture, and we are in a culture that has no sense about these things at all. So, I mean, just anymore, you can just turn on a typical cop show or something like that on TV and be face to face with really perverse things that are intended to grab you and shake you up. And we can't ignore that. I mean, it's a very good question you're asking. We can't ignore that. I don't want to lock myself up in a monastery somewhere, but at the same time, I want to be sensitive as to what am I doing to my head. I mean, I don't want to turn myself into someone, I already am, but I don't want to make it any worse to turn myself into the sort of person whose mind is not is running in channels that it just shouldn't be running in because I keep exposing myself to those channels. So that's a tricky thing, but it's a really good question.
A couple of comments that we males have to be aware that the visual stimulation of just a naked female body and simulation of sex acts and stuff like that, just by its very nature, has a drug-like effect on us. I mean, it just does. And we just have to, so we have to realize, I mean, just like we would not take certain drugs because we realize that they can become addicting and that they can get their hook in us, we need to do the same thing with sexuality. And pornography is intending to get us hooked. They make their money by getting us hooked. So we can do ourselves the biggest favor by just monitoring our reaction. And if we know it's something that's going to get my adrenaline going, don't expose myself to it. When I was younger, fortunately, I'm getting old enough that nothing fazes me. But when I was younger, I would sometimes just close my eyes during those, you know, obligatory sex scenes in the movies, just because I knew it wasn't doing me any good. It wasn't going to have any positive effect on me. The other thing, and this is not the visual thing, but this is just the way in which sex gets portrayed in the movies and in music and in song, so it doesn't even have to be visual, is it creates a whole story and mythology about what sexuality is that can't real life can't match it. That's not what real sexuality is. I wish I had this folk. There's this folk song. I was in Borders and I listened to this folk song by a female folk singer. I think she'd probably be a feminist, but a great song about basically how come real women aren't like that. Talking about all the ways in which women are portrayed as panting for men and having. Women are portrayed in these songs and movies exactly the way men want them to be, exactly the way men think that they want them to be. And the fact is, real women aren't like that. I think that was the name of the song, was Real Women. And as a young married person, it took me a while to realize there's nothing wrong with my wife. It's all those stories I believed that are the lie, is the fiction. My wife is just fine. It's all the images that you get from actors playing roles that they don't even live out in their own real lives. It's those roles that are not real. And not only pornography, but just all the sex scenes and movies and so on create a set of expectations that have nothing to do with human sexuality as God created it. And I think it's important to realize that and be on the guard against that.
I'll just jump on that bandwagon a little bit too. I think the same is true for women with romantic comedies or romantic stories that create expectation or desire that can be a drug for women. The same way visual stimulus can be a drug for men, because there's such a longing for that kind of emotional. And when you see that portrayed so big on the screen, it's just so enveloping, and yet it's so not true to life that it's I think it's really important to know that, and to know that this vision of life, I mean, there's not going to be a soundtrack for one thing. I mean, you can play music in the background, but there's not really going to be a soundtrack. And I think, you know, what you have to keep in mind is when a scene is filmed, they do it over and over again. They have a set director. They have a costume director. They have people putting every detail into that scene that they want to have it produce a particular effect. And real life just isn't like that. So, and I think it takes away from the real. It's like that's an image of something that might be pretty or attractive, and there might be some things that are really even okay about it. It's not necessarily horrible, but reality is stickier than that. Reality is bumpier, and it's like it's about this person. It's not about this experience or this event. It's about this person and how I relate myself to them and how I learn to care about them. And that's so much more satisfying in the end because it's real. it's solid, or it can be. So
the irony of what you're saying is that all those people portraying those amazing roles in the movies, they can't keep their own marriages together. It's all fake.
Well, and I personally think that's one of the real issues with it is that for the actors involved, I mean, they're having sex. I mean, even if they're just faking it, it would be very difficult to not be communicating with this language. If you go to work and your work is to act out a sex scene with the guy that you've signed on to a film with, weird. Weird culture. Woo! And I feel the same way about violence. We wouldn't go there. Okay.
Except 24, right?
Yeah, except 24. I make exceptions.
So I'm probably misunderstanding you, but it seems like sex is like innately sensual, or well, it's like the one activity in my life, at least, where all my senses are freaking out with joy, or it's just a good thing, you know, like changing my oil is a non-sensual activity. That is good, yes. And so I just need some clarification on that, I guess. On why sensuality, or maybe the definition of your definition of sensuality, and then why is that bad, biblically or whatever. And also, is sensuality always bad? Like, I guess eating one of Janelle's desserts, you know, is a very sensual experience for me. And I mean, food is created, I guess, to sustain us physically and not be, and, you know, to give us energy, but it's also very sensual. I mean, it could be a very sensual experience.
Are you not ashamed of yourself to be admitting these things here in front of
me? Pardon me?
You enjoy sex. You enjoy dessert.
I know. It's disgusting.
What kind of a Christian are you?
I know. That's what I'm questioning right now.
Right. Well, you're the one who should clarify it. You're the one who said it. Well... Okay, so let me make a comment, and then Jack can, because I really do agree with what Jack's saying, but I don't think you're catching quite what he has in mind here.
Good.
That,
okay.
I think that we ought to take. I mean, if we look at the creation and think about the way God has made things, that we have to pay attention to the fact that God has made our bodies in such a way that it doesn't actually take much for us to end up having this incredible sensual experience. I mean, sexuality is built into us. Every one of us is a sexual being, and we just know. I mean, this is just the way this works. And it's not like, I mean, it's not like going off and buying, you know, some strange weed from some place so that I can shoot it into my veins and have this weird experience. It's just built this way. I mean, let's just be frank about this, right? I mean, we all are aware that I could just sit down and start thinking about things in my head and create an incredible sensual experience in my body. So, what I'm getting at here is that God made us this way. I mean, this clearly there's something about this that is not bad, but it is the way we are made to be. I would say, I mean, Jack is, I think, is using the word sensuality in a very technical sense here. That is, that I am, my actions are being driven by the priority of the sensual experience that I'm going to get over other considerations. Even in marriage, where clearly sex has all of the sensory overload things that you're talking about, in a marriage relationship, there are times where in my relating to my spouse, I have to do things that may rob the experience of all of the sensual pizzazz that it could have. I mean, you know, out of sensitivity to my spouse, a number of things that might be involved. If my sensual experience were the primary focus, then it would suggest that anything that I could do to enhance the sensual experience would be the thing that I ought to do, and anything that takes away from the sensual experience would be bad. But I think what we're seeing in sexuality is that God has said, if you're willing to live within the moral constraints of love and submission to my created order, the avoidance of perversion, living contentedly with what you have and not lusting after what you don't have and all of that, there is a sensual experience to be had here that I intended to be pleasurable, and seeking it within those bounds is what sex is about. It's not, we're not getting together in a sexual relationship, man and wife, because and saying, well, we don't really care whether we have a good time here or whether this is enjoyable. We're just doing it because it's the right thing to do. That's not the way God made it to work. But still, I mean, a guy might be in a place where I could enhance my sexual experience if I forgot about my wife and had a fantasy about something else while I was having a sexual relationship with my wife. I could have an enhanced sensual experience. And I'm sorry, I think we have to talk frankly about some of these things, but so I'm not trying to make anyone uncomfortable, but the fact is, that's a thing that could happen. Well, that doesn't mean necessarily that I'm making the sex better by making it more sensually pleasing to myself. I have actually taken away from it because I have forgotten that there's more involved to this than just the pursuit of a sensual experience. That's how I'm understanding what Jack is saying. So, yeah, within the confines of what is right, the sensual experience is great. Just like God made food to be enjoyed. I think there's nothing wrong with that, with enjoying that dessert. But there comes that place. Have we crossed the line into gluttony? Have I selfishly put pressure on my wife, the expectation that she's going to make this often because I really want to have it, when it actually kind of puts a burden on her? I mean, you know, all of that kind of stuff. That's where sensuality has become the rule. So, Jack, you tell me if that's what you meant.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, take an analogy. Take something like competitive sports. Competition is the goal within a competition, a sports competition. It kind of detracts from the competition if you're not competing. but hopefully it's not the purpose of competitive sports. The purpose is health, discipline, character building. I mean, there are all kinds of things that result from engaging in sports competition. The strategy is to compete to win. But if you make the primary focus to win, that's when you start bribing, cheating, breaking the rules, doing all kinds of things that actually destroy sports competition, even though you are getting the victories. It's the same with sexuality. The purpose is not sensual pleasure, but sensual pleasure is certainly always the strategy in a act of sexual intimacy. That's what you're strategically setting as the immediate goal. But if you don't quite reach that goal, you haven't destroyed the purpose for being sexual beings together in a marriage relationship. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's good. Could you share some of Janelle's desserts?
I don't think so.
She doesn't make the big helping anymore.
Jack, I might need just a little bit of clarification. So there's... Hey. Yeah.
You can hear? Okay. I just couldn't see it.
Here, I'll stand. So there's three purposes. There's like relational, procreation, and sensual. And I guess my main question earlier was like kind of what made you choose relational as the primary one? You know, because obviously we're really familiar with the sensual being focused too heavily on, and then there's like the procreation being perverse in Catholic or whatever. So I'm wondering if like, can you perverse the relational if you're focusing too heavily on that aspect? Is it more you just have to kind of balance them all out, or it really should be the primary focus?
Well, I think it really should be primary because what I think the Bible presents, notice that the Bible never really talks about sex per se. It talks about sex by talking about marriage. Like even in Genesis. If I'm right in the way I'm understanding Genesis, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. That's about the marriage relationship. That's the nature of the marriage commitment that is being talked about. And then in 1 Corinthians, when Paul quotes that passage, he quotes that passage in the context of why we shouldn't see a prostitute. Well, why do you talk about marriage in the context of something that's being pursued for sensuality, for the purposes of sensual pleasure and that alone? I think it's because Paul is making the case there that the whole very purpose of sex, the nature of sex is such that it is a language that communicates what the marriage commitment is really all about. That's what it's for. And then I've built my whole theory of biblical, of sexuality from the Bible based on that assumption. So if my theory is wrong, then I'm wrong. But I think my theory matches the nature of sexual ethics in the Bible, the theory of sexuality as best I can glean it from the Bible. It just all fits together. And that the way it all fits together leads to the conclusion that no, the relational is the purpose of sexual intimacy. Pleasure is attached to that as something that God has put together with it, and procreation is attached to it as something that God has put together with it, but they are not the purpose. They are outcomes that are attached to it.
Okay, that might be what's clear. Because you said primary purpose, and so I kind of thought the other two were just other purposes, but that does clear it up a bit. Like, they're actually in a different category in
right.
that sense.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Perhaps the primacy can be seen, I don't know, but it strikes me that experience tells us that sometimes sexuality is separated from procreation. Sometimes people can't have kids, but the purpose of sexuality has not been diminished in a marriage by that. And sometimes, for whatever reason, in the way things are at the present time, perhaps the sensual delights of the process are not all that they once were or could be or something like that. But once again, it doesn't diminish the role and importance of it. But if sex were to result in kids and have a lot of pleasure, but it were not an expression of the commitment of it was in the context of a bad relationship, then I'd say sex has really lost its, I mean, now we've lost something that shouldn't be lost. I mean, that's the thing that has to be there, even if the others were to fall away. And I don't know if that's a good argument exactly, but it does at least fit the picture that you're painting.
I just have a quick question. I'm not sure if you've already addressed this or not, but on the procreation thing, you know, it's wrong to enter a relationship and enter only for sex, but you don't want kids or something like that. Is it, it's still considered wrong if, say, you don't necessarily want biological kids, but you're wanting to have an adopted child? Is that fall under the same category, or how does that exactly work into the whole thing? Because I'm a little unclear on that.
Obviously, good question. You got it.
I'm willing to raise kids as long as they're not mine, is what you're saying?
Well,
that's the.
I'm dealing with, like, from my parents' experience is I'm an adopted child, and so they did not necessarily want biological kids, but they were I'm not exactly sure what their mindset was at the time or anything, so I'm basing this off of my assumptions of how it might have worked their mindsets. I'm just kind of curious, you know, does that fall under the category of wrong or right, or is it one of those gray areas that you really can't answer?
Yeah, I should think that they must have had some individual reasons before God that, and I can't be the judge of that.
Nor can I.
So it's obviously if they're willing to raise kids, they weren't rebelling against the very notion of taking that kind of responsibility. So that doesn't at all fall into the category that I was talking about earlier.
That's what I was curious about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So you'd have to get inside their mind and know exactly what their thinking was and what their resistance to the idea of having their own kids was. But that may very well be appropriate rather than inappropriate. I can't answer that.
Maybe I don't need to make this comment because maybe this has come out in the weeks before. It did a little bit in the first week, and I meant to apologize for not being here last week. I had an emergency situation that I had to deal with. You're right, yeah. Well, it's a serious medical condition. Okay, so, but what I was going to say is I think it's important for us to understand. This is a very hard thing for us to get the right perspective on. I think we can easily fall off on one side or the other. When we're talking about ethics of any sort, I mean, what would the Bible say is right or wrong? Why are we asking that question? I mean, what is it exactly that we're looking for? And it is easy for us to fall into all sorts of different attitudes towards that. Our concern can be, I want to know whether it's right or wrong so I can know whether I can feel justified in the way I do things. Or I want to know whether it's right or wrong so I can decide whether that person's a good person or a bad person or something like that. We need to understand right up front that the main issue that we confront when it comes to biblical ethics of any sort is that we violate them. I mean, we have a serious problem before God. I'm not going to be able to go before God and take Jack's list and say, look, see all of these virtues here? I did all those. You know, I didn't violate one of those rules that Jack said you're not supposed to do. Which I don't believe you if you say that, but you might be able to make a case like that. But that's not the point. I mean, and Jack may have it wrong, I mean, here or there. Maybe his theory has not quite, I mean, he's trying to understand what explains why the Bible approves of what it does and why it doesn't approve of what it does, and get a general sort of principle here as to how we think about this. I personally think that Jack has done a great job in thinking about this stuff. I have been tremendously helped by his thinking here. I think it's very clear, and at different spots I might adjust it a little bit this way or that way, but I think it's really great. But if it is great, so what? I mean, what do we care about this stuff in the end? And it seems to me, for myself, what's at the heart of this picture that Jack is painting here is this idea that, you know, I live in a culture, I have my own way of thinking about things, and I live in a culture that has a way of thinking about things, and we all live as if reality is this world that I live in, what it tells me is true and what it tells me it is important, together with what I feel like. That's kind of reality, is my feelings plus the message my culture gives me. And what we're trying to say here is, actually, no, reality is that there is a God with a certain character and purpose who made the world and who made me. And I am going to come in touch with reality the more that I, one, acknowledge that I am not what I ought to be, and to learn what telos God has for this creation. What's the point of this stuff? All of us are going to fall short in many ways. I know perfectly well that those of you who are are single and are working out relationships, and maybe you're going to get married and all of that stuff, I can just guarantee you that it can be a messy process, and there'll be things that, oh, I probably shouldn't have done that, and oh, you know, I'm not sure whether we should be doing this or not, and all of that. It's messy and it's hard and it's difficult. But the question is, do I care about my creator and what he made me to be? And that's the purpose for going through all this stuff, is not to make you feel guilty about the way you behave, or it's certainly not because we want to affirm the thing that has happened in the Christian church, that somehow we have kind of communicated this message that sexual sins are so bad that if you have any in your life, you really shouldn't be hanging around with pure people like us. I mean, it's incredible how much the church has communicated something like that. No, what we want to look at is, it makes sense. This powerful force, this thing that has so much to do with the relationship between a man and a woman in a marriage and leads to children and all of this, certainly the creator of the universe has some ideas to what this is for and what it's about. And to wake up and say, you know, I kind of like to understand what that's about, and to be grateful to God for the grace that is offered to me in my selfishness for having abused the gift of sexuality that I have, that's where the action is. So a particular thing, you know, I think I agree with everything on Jack's list, but the purpose of the list is not for you to go away and beat yourself up about what a terrible person you are or something like that. It's, okay, yeah, this makes sense. This is the sort of person I have been created to be, and that's why we all need salvation so much, because we have fallen so far short of that. And that's really why we would do this. And, I mean, it's helpful. I mean, I have to say, Robbie and I, when we met and decided we were interested in each other and hung around for a long time together, a long time because I was afraid to get married, and so it was a long time. One of the things that was really helpful to us, we messed up in a lot of ways in working out that relationship stuff, but we had a chance to hear Jack talk about this stuff in the early days of when he was just kind of putting together his thinking about this. And I can just not tell you how helpful it was to us to not, I mean, we recognized that in a lot of ways we had not been what we had should be in this stuff, but it was just so helpful to sort of get your bearings. Just, you know, this is in general kind of what we're talking about here. So that's, I would just hate for anyone to think, you know, oh, no, I've just discovered that somebody I know has been violating Jack's rule 3.5. You know, that's not, yeah, well, probably, and we a lot more, too, if we were to go into that. But that's not the spirit of this. I hope you understand that.
I just want to go over the rejection of procreation that you guys are talking about. I'm still just unclear with where you're coming from with that, just because I don't necessarily agree that
there are some couples who are married and have been married for quite a long time and just don't have kids, not because they don't want to deal with them, but it just doesn't come up in their lives.
Okay, so the question was about the issue of whether procreation should be a part of, and she was saying that she's not sure she agrees with what you were saying, and she knows of married relationships, not where the people are rebellious and rejecting the idea of kids, but it just didn't really go that way. Are you saying that somehow if it is physically possible for you to have kids, you ought to have kids, and it is obviously wrong if you don't?
No, I would never say it's obviously wrong if you don't, because again, I mean, it's kind of like the last question. It really depends. So much of evil depends upon my hard attitude toward God. I mean, you remember my general theory was being hostile to God's character or his role or his values or his creation or his purposes. And if there's something else going on other than hostility, then I'm in no position to stand in judgment over that and say, just because it's a little bit out of the ordinary, therefore I know it's wrong. I guess that's my answer. Is that, no, I'm not prepared to say they're wrong.
My question is going back. Can you hear me, by the way? Mm-hmm. Okay. Going back to when Walter had asked his question about the way people were relating to each other, and Jack, you talked about the state of insecurity, basically, and not knowing where you stand with someone. When you're dealing with that insecurity, I'm just wondering, when you're trying to bring that to God and say, okay, this will get resolved, and thy will be done in this situation, how exactly are you supposed to feel while it's not resolved? Because I feel like if I'm saying thy will be done, then I shouldn't feel insecure, I just shouldn't feel insecure about it. But on the other hand, well, I do. And I just think that, I mean, I kind of think you should feel insecure because that's really wrestling with it and dealing with it. But how does, this whole thy will be done thing, that's difficult for me. What is that supposed to look like, I guess, is my question.
It'll feel like Jesus did in the Garden of Gethsemane when he said thy will be done. He was stressed out of his ever-loving mind.
Can I add something too? I think that's right, and that, you know, I think our feelings, and it's weird that I can't see you, but
sorry.
Hi, hi there. I think it's just really true that tension is what creates the need for a decision in a lot of ways, and so the decision-making process is very full of tension, and yet the tension itself is not the problem. It's that we don't yet have enough information to make the decision often. And so just really trying to hold on to myself in that process and to just know that I have to gather more information and that when I know, I'll know. I mean, it's very difficult to be in that kind of indecision. And yet I think the biggest gift we can give ourselves is time and just working with that intense struggle and yes, asking God for direction and guidance and it will come. I think it's not always what we want it to look like or what we hope for. And I think that's another piece is that if I start to feel settled about the answer and it's not the answer I was hoping for, then that's a whole other bag of worms, if you will. It's like, then I have to work with my disappointment and my wrestling with why did this fail or what isn't working about it or something like that. It's very difficult. I don't know if I'm helping at all with what you're talking about, but I just think our feelings can be so big. I think that they're really important. I don't think that they're just to be kind of just put them in a bottle and wait for this to pass, but rather they can be the information that I continually have to struggle with and work with as I'm going through that process of trying to trust God and wait to see what it is that he's bringing or not bringing. And that's kind of a lot of life, really. I mean, is working with that kind of tension. So
part of the paradigm that we're working from is that spirituality does not bring tranquility. You know, trusting in God, trusting in Jesus doesn't give you peace. It grounds you in reality. But being grounded in reality may be very tumultuous, psychologically, emotionally, and so on. You may be buffeted around by all kinds of things, but you're anchored in what is real, what is right, what is good, what is true. And that's the stability that hope and faith brings, rather than tranquility and peace. And I realize that's a very different paradigm than a lot of different Christian traditions, that, and it doesn't sell as well as the message that come to Jesus and he'll give you peace. But frankly, it's just not, that's just not true. He doesn't. I'll never forget when I was in college, Moshe Rosen, who is the guy who founded Jews for Jesus, who was giving a lecture, and I went to his lecture, and I wish I could do it. He had a Jewish Brooklyn accent. And he started the thing, "Sometimes you hear it said, come to Jesus and he will make you very happy. Well, I've come to Jesus and sometimes he makes me very unhappy." And went on from there. But it always struck me how that was the first time I got introduced to the notion, yeah, that's right. This isn't about happiness. This is about something else. Oh, I know what he said. "Sometimes he makes me unhappy, but it's always very real." That's what he said.
And just to add to that, I think it's also, that's so important to know that that struggle doesn't mean I'm not trusting God. Right. I mean, it could be very much in the middle of that I'm trusting God, and that struggling with it is what it looks like to trust God. It's not settling for a simple answer or rushing to the first sign of clarity, but actually being willing to be in the indecision could be very much what trusting God looks like.
That'll probably come up again later in the quarter. But we need to close this. We'll stick around for any of you who want to